Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know how we say all the time the American consumer is the backbone of this economy? Well, not to put too fine a point on it, but what is the matter with you people? Seriously. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It's the 13th of August today. I don't like to yell at you guys. You all know that. But we have, as item one today, yet another indicator that paints a somewhat meh picture of the current state of the American economy. The July report on retail sales was out from the Commerce Department this morning, flat from a month earlier, the worst report since January, in fact, when at least we had the weather as an excuse not to shop. So, what gives? Tracy Samuelson takes this one.
Trying to get inside the head or wallet of the American consumer can be dizzying. Earlier this year, we were buying cars in droves. But that was pent-up demand, says Chris Christopher. He's the director of consumer economics at IHS Global Insight. He says one reason these July retail numbers are less than stellar is because people spent their money on cars.
And then even, after those months, The discretionary spending is a little bit lackluster. They take it a little bit easier on other items that are not necessities.
In a word, consumers are cautious. Susan Villamari covers consumer insights for IRI, a market research company. She says coming out of the recession, we've learned to budget.
For example, 3/4 of consumers make a shopping list before they go to the grocery store. And by and large, consumers are sticking to the list that they've made.
And it's not just that we're being responsible. Wage growth has been fairly anemic. And consumers have made paying down their debts a priority, says Candace Corlett, the president of WSL Strategic Retail.
It's a very good thing for shoppers. It's less good for our economy, which thrives on consumers overspending.
But it's not that shoppers are all savings and no fun. Corlett says products just need to be extra exciting to tempt us. She says the number of people walking around with new Apple products or fitness trackers is proof of that. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Amazon would like to make it easier for you to spend money. It's moving into the mobile payment business, a slice of the economy already well populated by companies like Square and PayPal. They make credit card readers that plug into smartphones and tablets and so let smaller retailers take plastic. Amazon's local register, it's called, will do that and take a cut of every dollar spent, as do the others. But the decidedly not small retailer has another thing in mind as well, big data. Marketplace's David Gura reports.
Amazon knows a lot about how we shop, about what we search for, what ads we click, what devices we use.
Within Amazon's world, right, they have a tremendous insight into our online behaviors.
Tech analyst Colin Gillis is with BGC Partners.
But they don't have access into our offline purchasing.
And to get a better sense of us as consumers, Amazon needs that. Gillis says that with this new product, Amazon will collect new data on what we buy at stores and restaurants.
That insight into our offline behavior will be useful to them.
Amazon wants to know what we buy regularly, how we pay for those items, and maybe in the future, Amazon could sell us those items. James Cordwell is an internet analyst with Atlantic Equities. He says Amazon, which makes less than a penny on every dollar of revenue, is under more pressure than ever to make money. And Amazon Local Register may help the company do that.
But over and above that, it's about further locking in third parties into its platform.
Getting stores to use Amazon and Amazon products to do business. RJ Hadavi, an analyst with Morningstar, wonders if local retailers will be interested in that, even though the company charges less per transaction than Square or PayPal.
There's going to be some reluctance on the part of small merchants to share any kind of data with Amazon.
That's because data that could benefit Amazon could hurt those small merchants in the long run. If Amazon sees that your business is doing well, Hadavi says, well, there's nothing to stop it from competing against you. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
No pressure here, American consumers, but at least Wall Street was spending money today. Up arrows all the way around. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A A shipment of the experimental Ebola drug ZMapp arrived in Monrovia, Liberia today. It's meant for two Liberian doctors who became infected with the disease while out treating patients. More than 1,000 people have died so far in West Africa, including 3 people in Nigeria. Tomi Oladipo is the BBC's correspondent there. We got him in Lagos. Tomi, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on the program.
What is it like there in Lagos? Is this disease now something that's present on people's minds?
Certainly. I mean, there's a lot of talk about it in the news about what the damage is doing across West Africa. And Lagos, for example, is a city of close to 20 million people, very densely populated. And there are fears that with such a virus here, it could spread easily. And so there is concern, but I wouldn't say there's any panic or anything of the sort.
As you ride a bus, though, or as you go to the market to pick through fruit, is it something that's on people's minds? I mean, this is a disease, as we know, that's not difficult to transmit.
Well, Ebola can spread through physical contact, and people seem to know that now here in Nigeria. So there is a lot of caution now. Even just shaking hands, people are a bit more reluctant to do that now. So yes, when it comes to all of that, in fact, you go to different places. I was at the gym this morning, and they had hand sanitizers all around the place. So anybody using equipment, had to clean their hands. So that's generally the sense of the way things are, just to stay safe.
Have you talked to people in Sierra Leone or other countries who've been dealing with this? Are they seeing the same thing there? They must be, because it's worse there.
It's much worse there. I mean, Nigeria has only just about 13 cases of the Ebola virus. Meanwhile, in those other countries, they have hundreds of people infected, hundreds have died as well. So there, it's a lot more difficult for people to go about things. For example, in Liberia and Sierra Leone, where the military has come out and is restricting movement, so people can't even get across, for traders trying to get their goods from one town to the next, or people just traveling. Those kinds of movements have been restricted just so that the virus would not spread.
Have you been talking to small business people? Are they seeing anything just in terms of sales and crowds in their stores?
It depends on what kind of sales we're talking about. For example, in Nigeria, we've got this kind of roast beef, which is sold in skewers and made out in the open. It's popular. It's a delicacy around the country. And a lot of the sellers we've spoken to, they say their sales have gone down. Some of them would have maybe 200 customers a day, and then now saying they're getting about 50 because people are just staying away and restricting what they eat. When it comes to general business, things seem to be still going on as usual.
Mm. Tomi Oladipo, the BBC's correspondent in Lagos, Nigeria. Tomi, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
This being radio, you're just going to have to believe me when I tell you that I am soaking wet right now and freezing cold. Here's the audio proof, if that helps at all.
I accept the challenge. Oh, man. Oh, my God.
I can't even tell you how cold that was. We will, of course, have the video up soon if it's not out there already. I took the Ice Bucket Challenge today, the awareness-raising campaign that's been taking social media by storm the past couple of weeks in support of the fight against ALS, better known as Lou Gehrig's disease. The National ALS Association and its chapters have pulled in more than $5 million in donations just between the end of July and today. That's about 4 times what they got in the same period last year. Marketplace's Annie Baxter explains how it worked.
While groups like the ALS Association are getting gobs of money and new donors from the effort, the group spokeswoman, Carrie Monk, says she and her colleagues had nothing to do with it all.
I wish I could take credit for this incredible viral phenomenon. I'd be a PR genius if that was the case.
Instead, the credit seems to go to a few individuals who themselves suffer from ALS. It's a neurodegenerative disease that causes an individual's muscles to stop functioning. The disease is fatal. Victims eventually lose the ability to move, speak, and breathe. Pete Frates, a former Boston College baseball player, suffers from the disease and has helped the Ice Bucket Challenge spread. His dad, John Frates, says his 29-year-old son got keyed into the challenge from a fellow ALS sufferer.
It looked like it was just going to be for, entertainment purposes around our family and friends. Then it morphed into a little bit of, hey, if you don't do this challenge, you better donate.
Sarah Durham is the president of Big Duck, a communications firm for nonprofits. She says other fundraising campaigns have also grown organically. Durham says Planned Parenthood appeared to benefit from someone sending out an email that went viral a couple years ago. Durham says the only downside can be that the charities that benefit from grassroots campaigns might scramble to catch up.
It makes it hard for nonprofits because oftentimes they're reacting to something that's already out there that they didn't get any lead time to plan for or prepare for.
But in fundraising, that's not a terrible problem to have. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I really want to make sure that if I'm going to create a DIY or something that's going to be sponsored by a company, that it still feels authentically me.
Blogging and the changing business thereof. But first, let's do the numbers. Markets clawed back all the ground they lost yesterday, which admittedly was not a whole lot. The Dow Industrial is up 91 points today, about 0.5%, closed at 16,651. The Nasdaq jumped 44 points, about 1%, ended things at 44.34. The S&P 500 bounced 12 points higher, 2/3 of 1%, 19.46 there. Retailers had a tough day. Macy's lost more than 5% after profits fell short of estimates. Kohl's shares lost nearly 1.5%. Nordstrom unzipped 0.8% today. Candy Crush creator King Digital Entertainment spiraled down 23% after the company reported weaker than expected revenue. SeaWorld Entertainment off 32% after third quarter earnings missed estimates. Attendance at the theme park has been affected by controversy over the treatment of its captive whales. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The House Veterans Affairs Committee holds a field hearing in South Dakota to discuss challenges in rural America, infrastructure needs, and access to care. Walmart is scheduled to report quarterly earnings. And batter up, the Little League Baseball World Series gets underway in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. I'm Michelle Phillippe. Safe!
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Taxes are no fun. We all obviously know that, which is why this month residents of 15 states will revel in the completely legal avoidance of one particular tax, if only for a weekend. Sales tax holidays might not be so good for state budgets, but Jeff Tyler reports consumers and retailers simply cannot get enough of them.
Retailers like the sales tax holidays because they motivate consumers. Jim Sluzewski is spokesman for Macy's. He says people living on the border of a state offering a tax holiday will travel to shop.
It can be a pretty significant increase in traffic in the store and sales.
Why are tax holidays so popular?
There's absolutely a psychological impact here that is bigger than the money.
Craig Sherman is the spokesman for the National Retail Federation. He says consumers generally hold out for sales with at least 25% off.
So if retailers were to offer 5 or 10% off, consumers would laugh at them. But when shoppers can save that same 5 or 10% by virtue of not paying tax, it goes way beyond the amount of money involved.
Of course, consumers save money at the register, but it's really the states that pay. Verenda Smith is deputy director at the Federation for Tax Administrators, the Association of State Tax Agencies.
The first time I heard about a state tax holiday, I laughed until I cried.
She says there are 27 tax holidays scheduled this year.
They're expensive. They do tend to distort the economy a little bit, but people love them.
If tax holidays disappeared, would retailers lose much business? I asked Joy Hirons with Miller's School Supplies in Central Florida.
Well, to be honest with you, it probably wouldn't make a whole lot of difference because the people have to purchase these items anyway.
Tax exempt or not. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
The healthcare industry, and it is an industry, walks a fine line between being an essential public good and profitability, or at least not actively losing money. And with more and more medical balances due coming out of consumers' pockets, thanks in part to a rise in high-deductible health insurance, hospitals are thinking really hard about the best ways to collect. From the Health Desk at WHYY Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has that story.
CEO Craig Froudy says business is booming for his company, Care Payment, which works for hospitals offering patients no-interest payment plans.
We will actually double in revenue this year, and we'll probably double again in 2015.
The Kaiser Family Foundation reports workers with deductibles has jumped from 55% to 78% since 2006. Froudy says that's why hospitals are lining up outside his door.
What we're really seeing is, you know, patients are having to figure out how they're going to afford health care.
Hospitals do a good job getting money from insurers, but when it comes to what individuals owe, Froudy says it's just about 17 cents on the dollar. And that won't cut it as collections becomes a bigger part of the business.
We're trying to get ahead of this curve because we want to be able to continue to be financially viable.
Melanie Wilson is with North Carolina-based Novant Health. 2 years ago, Novant stopped offering a payment plan with a 12% interest rate and introduced a no-interest option. She says more people started paying their bills.
They see that we're not here just to make money. We're here to do the right thing.
Not all hospitals can go that route, though. Sandra Wolfskill with the Healthcare Financial Management Association expects some hospitals to keep using loans or credit cards with interest because those lenders give hospitals money up front.
I think the hospitals that are financially stressed may be more inclined to go with the credit card because it moves their cash flow much quicker.
Wolfskill says patients often don't know what they owe until the bill shows up. She says hospitals got to find a way to make that stop. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Last year, the California legislature passed a bill telling state officials to set up a seismic early warning system, seconds worth of a heads up that could save I don't know how many lives in the case of an earthquake. Geologists for the federal government have a prototype, but it would take tens of millions of dollars to scale it up. But this being capitalism, there is a private company that says it could get the job done for a whole lot less. From KPCC here in Los Angeles, Sandon Totten explains.
It's one of those baking hot days in Palm Springs. Things are calm at a local fire station. And then...
Seismic event detected. Seismic event detected.
Don't freak. It's not a quake, just a demonstration. Blake Getz works for Seismic Warning Systems, the company behind this quake alert tool. It relies on two sensors the size of paperback novels.
They're bolted about a foot off the floor on a bearing wall in this building.
Those sensors can detect an earthquake seconds before serious shaking begins. With that brief window, the system does three things automatically.
It opens the doors, it turns on the lights, and it activates the radio system, and the firefighters can then drop, cover, and hold or evacuate the building.
Seismic Warning Systems has outfitted more than a dozen fire stations with this sort of early warning system. The company also recently landed a $250,000 contract to expand its work into a neighboring county.
We have cracked the code. We can detect, analyze, and warn of a dangerous earthquake in less than 1 second.
That's Rocky Saunders, a sales rep for Seismic Warning Systems. He says the sensors detect subtle vibrations called P waves. These occur just as a quake starts and travel at about the speed of sound, meaning they reach the surface before the more damaging S waves that follow. It's that gap of time between the P waves and the S waves that allow a warning system to do its thing.
We essentially are listening and detecting and analyzing the DNA, if you will, of the earthquake.
The U.S. Geological Survey already has a similar system in place. Its network relies on hundreds of sensors near major faults. These could give up to a minute's warning before shaking reaches major cities. But that system is a prototype, requiring $38 million to build out. Saunders claims Seismic Warning could build a cheaper statewide network using investor capital. The company would then sell early warning subscriptions for about $100 a month.
So that's the difference. We do not require an investment by the state of California, and then there's a public benefit at a very inexpensive cost.
Of course, Seismic Warning Systems still needs more private funding to build its statewide network. The state of California wants both systems linked together. But USGS's Elizabeth Cochran says that's easier said than done.
Our concern is that it's not clear exactly how their system is functioning and whether it's functioning in the way that they claim it is.
She points out that Seismic Warning Systems won't divulge the details behind its technology. The company says that's a trade secret. And while the two sides have met numerous times, they haven't found a way to get past this. According to state law, California has until January of 2016 to set up an early warning system. And the law isn't picky about who builds it. From Los Angeles, I'm Sandon Totten for Marketplace.
There is really just one question in the media world today. How do you make money? Some have figured it out, some haven't. It's a question that applies to old media and new, big companies and small, really small companies sometimes. The blog has, over the past 10 or 15 years, proved a decent way for people to start a business built around their interests and, if they're good enough and stick to it long enough, make a living at it. Joy Cho runs Oh Joy. It's a style and design blog based here in Los Angeles from which she does make a living. Joy, thanks for coming to the studio.
Thanks for having me.
I guess we should do the origin story first, right? I mean, 2005, you've moved and you're looking for something to do, so you start a blog?
Yeah. So I had left New York, had a couple jobs there as a designer. I'd moved to Philadelphia with no job. And while I was interviewing, I had to start freelancing as a designer to make ends meet. In the meantime, a friend of mine suggested, why don't you start a blog? And I really was like, I don't know what a blog is.
Yeah.
I mean,
2005, right?
Yeah, 2005. Yeah. I never had read blogs. I had thought of them as simply online diaries. I thought of Doogie Howser back in the day when he was journaling on his computer.
Yeah, yeah.
And I really didn't think anybody would care what I had to say or anything. But as somebody who's very visual, who's always collecting things, who's always trying to save visuals for future reference, I thought, okay, well, at least I can put them online and I can share them with people if they decide they want to view them with me.
One of the reasons we wanted to talk to you was because you announced, what, just a couple of weeks ago, that you're going to get rid of advertising on your site.
Yes.
It's phasing out, I think we should say. I thought that was how bloggers made money, was getting ads up there and you know, using that as the platform.
Well, I really think it's changing. I had ads on my site for a very long time. However, in the last several years, brands and bloggers have been partnering together a little bit more on sponsored content.
Yeah.
And I find it to be much more meaningful, much more interesting, and much more creative, and a way to work with a brand in a way that it benefits everybody.
So how does that work? I mean, you know, pick a brand.
Sure.
and they come to you and say, hey, Joy, we dig your stuff. Let's do something together. Is that basically it?
Exactly. So a brand ranging from a tiny boutique brand to a very large corporation will start to see the value of working with somebody who has some sort of reach and some sort of aesthetic.
Let me get some metrics here. Mm-hmm. Just to get into the blogger language.
Sure.
Talk to me about your reach.
Okay. So my blog gets about 550,000 page views a month. I have various followings on social media, so over 100,000 on Instagram, mm-hmm. over 40,000 on Facebook, over 60,000 on Twitter,
okay.
And then on Pinterest, 13.5 million
Ooh.
Followers.
Wow, which makes sense for a design thing, right?
Yes.
Yeah, totally makes sense. Anyway, so the brands see your numbers and they say, all right, we got to hook up with this woman,
mm-hmm.
and then how does it go?
So they come to me with their purpose. For me, it's very important to know what that purpose is because obviously they have a motive and there's
mm-hmm.
a certain end goal that they have. But at the same time, for me, I really want to make sure that if I'm going to create a DIY or a recipe or a video or something that's going to be sponsored by a company, that it still feels authentically me and it still feels like content that my readers would enjoy and it's not just a commercial.
Well, how much do you worry about either actually selling out or just being called a sellout?
Yes, it's certainly a concern. I think that every blogger, once you start to do this, it's something that you want to make sure that you're very aware of. Also, what I prefer is a lot of underwritten sponsored content. Say you have a bottle of water. Rather than it being, hey, this is Joy, here's a bottle of water, and I'm showing it in front of my face, and
yeah.
It's like a commercial, maybe we talk about something about feeling refreshed or a way to add really beautiful fruit ice cubes to a glass of water. And it's a little bit more about lifestyle. It's not necessarily about the water and that brand. And then, hey, P.S., this was brought to you in collaboration with XYZ Water Company.
Do you ever look around and acknowledging that it took you, what, 2 years to start making money from this thing?
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever look around and say, man, I get paid for this?
Yes. I mean, pretty much every day. It's pretty amazing.
Joy, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Joy Cho. The blog is called Oh Joy.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, which we found on 538.com, it's data culled from AOL's earnings report last week. First of all, AOL still has 2.3 million subscribers, interesting in and of itself. But also this, for $59.88 a year, you can get their baseline plan, which includes, among other things, unlimited dial-up service, which, it ought to be said, can be the only way to get online in a lot of rural parts of this country, but also two free wills from Hyatt Legal Planning, and just to drive their target demographic point home a little bit, an AARP membership as well. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Wednesday. Today, the Dow up 91 points, about 0.5%, closed at 16,651. The NASDAQ up 44 points, 1%. The S&P 500, 12 points higher, 0.2%. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.